So today's theme is slow energy policy in a time of global emergencies, the perils and promises of energy policy and religious communities. And I'm going to introduce our main speaker, Dr. Jeremy Kidwell, in a moment, and his respondent, Professor Mike Hume. Just to say that discussion is under the Chatham House rule, which means that you can report what's been said but not attribute particular things to any individual. And for the last 2.5 years, we have consistently maintained respectful and friendly exchanges during the discussion, and I'm sure we don't need to be reminded of that today. There are a number of themes that we are looking to explore through these seminars. Different topics will explore these in different ways to different degrees. What aspects of this case or this theme contribute to good or bad energy policy? What are the policy implications for the UK, Europe, and globally? And what other perspectives shed light on the case from different disciplines and stakeholder groups? Those are some of the core questions that we've been working on over the last 2.5 years that the project's been running. So let me introduce to you our main speaker. Dr. Jeremy Kidwell is lecturer in ethics at the University of Birmingham. He describes himself as an interdisciplinary scholar, so he's our kind of guy. He's trained in ethics and constructive theology with a background in the humanities, particularly literature and music. He has a decade of prior experience working in the high-tech sector. His work explores the problems facing our civilizations and ecologies without deference to disciplinary silos, and as a result, it's both critical, instructive, data-driven, and humanistic. Ticks all the boxes for this project. And modestly, he has the ambition of hoping that his work will help stitch back together the themes of nature and culture. So, but what are you going to do next year? He describes himself as doing this in the mode of a field philosopher. I'll let him explain to you what that is, or perhaps he's going to actually demonstrate it in the next half hour. He's the author of a book called Theology of Craft, 2016, and he's also the co-editor of Theology and Economics, A Christian Vision of the Common Good, 2015. So welcome, Jeremy. We look forward to your presentation. Your respondent, Professor Mike Hume, welcome, who's recently joined the Department of Geography at Cambridge in September. Prior to that, he was for 4 years Professor of Climate and Culture in the Department of Geography at King's London, where he was head of department. From 2000 to 2007, he was the founding director of the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research, another multidisciplinary project based at University of East Anglia. And prior to that, he worked in the Climate Research Unit at UEA. And he also adds, some of you may know this already, get ready to Google, he has the dubious honour of having 5 years' worth of his professional email correspondence released to public scrutiny as a result of the ClimateGate controversy. So get Googling right now, and you know, you'll find some interesting stuff. Actually, I particularly enjoyed the string of emails running down Cambridge. Obviously, the interview panel didn't come across that string of emails. He's the author of numerous publications. The one that I happen to know, and I think is one that he's best known by, is a wonderful book, Why We Disagree About Climate Change, from 2009. Let me just flag up quickly before Jeremy starts a couple of remaining seminars on the 13th of February and the 13th of March. And if you have suggestions for future themes or speakers, do get in touch with one of us or speak to Michael Pollitt, who's here. So, without further ado, let me introduce Jeremy and ask him to speak to us for 30 minutes. Cool. Thank you, Jeremy.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks to all of you for coming so long to hear the paper today. This paper came out of a workshop that the Good Energy Project did a year ago, I think. And I think you gave me 5 minutes, maybe. And so I tried to be maximally provocative. And Michael Pollitt. I think he was curious about one, at least one of the provocations. So what I'm going to try to do today is to unpack a little bit of that. And I should just say, I'm sure being a multidisciplinary group, you've got a number of different backgrounds here. And so I'm going to speak to the fictional political scientist who may or may not be in the room. But I hope you can kind of all come along for the ride. That's all right. And just also to say, the slides, I don't believe in PowerPoint, so this is a different kind of thing. So you can download it from my website. It's just jeremykibble.info. And I've got little footnotes and things. So if you want to chase down, or if you're listening at a different pace, you can. I won't blame you if you're slipping on your iPad. That's fine too. So just in terms of mapping out what I'm going to try to do this afternoon, it's going to be some preambles. I've got to answer some why questions to my imagined political scientist. And one of those, of course, has got to be why religion? Why on earth would we want to talk about religion when we're talking about energy policy? Another question that I'm probably going to need answers, why on earth would we talk about communities? So I'm going to probably need to provide a justification for that as well. Judging by your body language that you're a sympathetic crowd, so that's nice. You can come along with me. But it's also good, I think, just to kind of rehearse where we are in terms of the discourse on these things so that we can see sort of why it is that we've arrived in a certain way. And then I'll give a little bit of context that comes out of some of the GIS work that I've been doing and some of the field work that I and team members have been doing. And then I'll also try to hone in a little bit with the case study. I'm going to talk about a particular policy instrument in Scotland called the Climate Challenge Fund and why I think that works and some ways in which I think that it could be improved. Not because I'm picking on the Scottish government and their instruments, because they've got, frankly, a bit better stuff than we do right now, but because I think it's useful to take a case study approach so that we can zoom in, think about what's going on, and then zoom back out and think about where some of the ripples elsewhere for public policy. And just in terms of saying who I am as a field philosopher, if you haven't run across that before, I'm an interdisciplinary theologian, but I think it's quite important to deploy our ideas in the field, that is, in real places with real human beings. So this is why, as a philosopher, I'm doing ethnographic work, and also why I'm doing quantitative work, mildly quantitative GIS work. So I'm happy to unpack that if there's anyone else who wants to become a field philosopher and join me. But I should probably launch into talking a little bit about slow energy policy and some of the perils and promises of trying to bring together religious communities and energy policy. So the obvious thing to say is that one of my primary preoccupations, I'm mostly an environmental philosopher, is what on earth are we going to do about climate change? And I think one of the first things that comes to mind is the IPCC, which is this amazing effort that's been going on for just about 3 decades now. And that was the primary public response to climate change in some ways. One of the things that the IPCC tries to do is sort of bury you under experts and expert commentary, and so I've given you some of the numbers there so we can just appreciate the aura of expertise. It is a lot of experts. I think it maybe Mike said in one of his books that it's almost like the IPCC working group created climate change trademarked in a way. And the aura that comes along with that is that this is a scientific undertaking, right? This is a problem that we can solve with information and analysis. And I think it's fair to say that most people now agree that that's probably not true. And one of the problems that's arisen from that particular policy approach which was taken is that we ended up with something which is mostly technocratic. It's a bit top-down. And as some good folks, and I've given you a footnote there, have said, it's decoupled from the social and political context of its material production. So what I'm trying to make here is an argument for why we need to think about culture. This is not original to me by any stretch of the imagination, but this is the context in which I'm trying to deploy some of this study of Scottish environmental activists. So we've got a problem where we're value-free, we're technocratic, we're top-down in our orientation, and as much as we'd love those things to work, and they worked a little bit maybe, they've not gotten us to where we need to be in terms of setting reasonable targets and actually achieving them in terms of mitigating climate change. And just to rehearse, there have been 4 reactions, maybe more, but I've just sort of distilled them here so we can think about them. One of them has been this attempt by scientists to hone their skills in the dark arts of science communication. That is, if we just set our information a little bit more effectively, maybe then people would act on it and they'd get rid of their cars and stop using coal. Jury's out on whether science communication is going to get us there. I tend to be a bit skeptical about that. There's been a project that started just a little bit after the first IPCC, looking into the human dimension, and you can click the link if you want to read more about that on Wikipedia. That was an attempt to chart policy responses that included humans. I'm not entirely sure whether culture was rigorously integrated as it could have been, but that's sort of getting us in the right direction. There's been a new emphasis on lay knowledge. This has come a bit more recently, I think, and the idea that perhaps alongside all of this scientific knowledge that we're producing, we need to actually pay attention to lay experience and the kind of knowledge that's developed in communities of practice, at the grassroots, that knowledge might be equally valid. I think probably the most strident voice on this recently has been Bruno Latour in his book Modes of Existence. A lot of good stuff there. But generally, a way of distilling this is to say that we're changing our research orientation if we're paying attention to lay knowledge. We're not starting with, what are you doing about climate change? We're starting with, how are you experiencing climate change? There's a fourth effort that's been underway, which has been to start to call upon various communities for moral leadership. I was one of the people who was quite surprised to see Cristiana Figueres speaking directly to people of faith to participate in the mitigation effort. And generally, they've responded, right? We've got Pope Francis coming out with an encyclical, Laudato Si. There's the good man himself with a big smile for us. That was in 2015. There's lots of other big declarations by religious leaders or consortia, like the Islamic Declaration. If you want to read them all, you can go to the Yale Forum website. They've got them all listed there. Just about every major world religion is represented, so you can pick your worldview and find your declaration. And I think there's a sense, at least this is the sense that I have, that political leaders are also responding to this new situation. In other words, they're starting to listen, or at least acknowledge that there's a voice that's coming from, in terms of the topic of discussion for today, they're coming from faith communities. And they're maybe thinking that our mitigation strategies might try to integrate some of those voices. Now, I just want to highlight something here, because I talked about this religious leader thing, and this is very much often our first port of call. And just take Laudato Si as an interesting case here, where I think if you talk to most people, most of my people, the eco-theologians, they think that Laudato Si was the best thing that ever happened to climate change, and that the world will never be the same. If you talk to normal people, as this pie chart on the right shows us, they've never even heard of it. A majority. And this was a survey of Roman Catholics in America, the people who should be hearing about encyclicals. So there's mediation, I think, that's happening here. I mean, that's fairly obvious if you're an anthropologist, that there's mediation with these kinds of top-down communications, but that's what's happening. Another interesting study found when they asked people about what their views were on climate change before and after the encyclical, but not with reference to it. Not much in terms of shifting here. What's particularly interesting is whether people think of global warming as a religious issue. That was 10% of respondents in March 2015, and slightly less in July of 2015, after the encyclical came out. So I think what I'm just trying to challenge here is this assumption that if we can get the messaging right at the top, we will really get things right. In some ways, this is just an extension of the IPCC strategy. You know, we marshal and mobilize things from the top, and then we disseminate them down. So what I'm trying to argue for is some attention to the grassroots. And there's a lot of work that needs to be done here, particularly in terms of religion and ecology. And one of the reasons for that is that most of the data that we've generated to date have been large-scale national surveys. And one of these is the PRI AAR report that came out about 2 years ago. They had the annual conference on climate change, so they had to do a report. So there's those kinds of things. The problem with them is that they mostly focus on the USA. They mostly focus on national level samples. So they imagine there's nothing different between a person that lives in Seattle and a person that lives in Houston, or say a person that lives in Yorkshire and a person that lives in London, which of course we know anecdotally surely can't be the case. So if you're interested, I've got a bibliography of all of this research if you want to kind of dig in yourself, and you can, again, click the slides and have a look at that. There's about 100 studies, roughly, that have come out on this subject, doing empirical research in terms of surveys for the most part. We can talk about that some more, but that's not what I want to talk about. I want to talk a little bit about some of the ways where all of these attempted strategies have led us to a policy situation where we're trying to connect with the grassroots, we're trying to connect with communities, but generally the policy instruments that we're working with are what I would gently say are uninflected, underinflected. And I think this issue is made even more acute by the stated attempt by government to devolve policy and environmental solutions to the community level. So it's not just that we're not really working well with them, but that we're not working well with community level action, and that's where we're putting the emphasis in terms of our the way we're speaking about public policy. I'm not sure in terms of funding instruments and all that. So here's my manifesto. I think to achieve our policy goals on climate change mitigation, we need more tailored policy instruments. We need to think about what's going on at the grassroots, and this requires certain kinds of knowledge. We need to know how do community groups function. We need to know whether religious ones are unique, particularly if they're unique in a positive way. A lot of the research is focused on some of the negative ways that especially white American evangelical Protestants seem to be not helping the world. And then I think we probably need to think about what gaps exist between policy and practice. So I'm going to make a little bit of a start at these three things and give you a sort of a whistle-stop tour of some of the research that I've been doing with several other researchers up in Edinburgh on Scottish eco-congregations. And this is an effort that we started in 2013. It was AHRC and ESRC funded. We got about £900,000 to pull together a team of about 12 researchers across all kinds of disciplines. We had a strangely large cluster of geographers, but they turned out to be very useful, so we didn't regret it. But we also had an economist, we had a historian, a couple of philosophers, a theologian, that was me. And as we started the research, I thought, well, if we're going to go around and interview people, we should probably find out about whether our sampling is robust enough. And what I discovered was there's no data set about community groups in Scotland. So I wanted to say, okay, well, if we're going to do someone in Inverness, maybe Perthshire, we want to know if we're balanced across where the groups actually are. There's just no data at all on it. There's also not very good data on where places of worship are in Britain. So I had to build all that data from scratch, and that's why I learned about GIS and did all that. And I'll tell you a little bit about what came out of that. But then we did the interviews, and we talked. We did interviews at about 50 different sites. We covered most of the country. I got to cover all of the wild regions, so I was in Orkney and the Hebrides and all over the place. And it was really interesting and quite inspiring to talk to some of these folks, but also a bit of shared frustration to find out about what they were trying to do and couldn't do. So right now, just in case you're wondering where the trajectory is, I'm scaling up the work that was in Scotland now. I just literally last week got a full data set from Arosha, who runs Eco Church in England and Wales, and I'm starting a partnership with Ecolisa, which is a kind of meta network in Europe of environmental groups. So the hope is to start to scale this stuff up and see, okay, is there anything going on in Scotland that's not in England, and so forth. So I want to dig into some case studies and talk a little bit about where I think some policy gaps might be. And I'll just start by giving you a very quick, high-level briefing on what community-level environmental action looks like in Scotland. So, live GIS map of where they are right now. And this is actually, it's a participatory research project. So practitioner groups actually have access to the platform that generates this, and they're updating the data set live. I mean, it's not like it changes every day, but, you know, it's moving. So this is a fairly accurate representation of all the environmental community groups in Scotland. We've got DTAS, that's Development Trusts, in blue. We've got Eco-Congregations in purple. We've got the Glasgow and West of Scotland Housing Federation, that's that big yellow blob in Glasgow. It's community land groups, city farms. There's some things that you can just see from looking at this, and that's part of why I wanted to start with the map. Oh, I'm sorry, Shetland. We've sort of cramped you out there, haven't we? There's Shetland. Hi, Shetland. So if you have a look at this, there's some things we can see, which is that they're everywhere, right? I think one of the things we were worried about as researchers was that the groups would be confined to urban areas, which they're not. And the little tiny red dots are community energy projects, which are associated with most of these groups that you see represented here. So what we wanted to know, though, with it further was how do these groups scatter across different types of social indices? I mean, the crass way of putting this, are certain groups wealthier than other groups? And how do they map across different types of demographics? So I've got a nice little scatter plot for you here. Here we've got the index of multiple deprivation. If you're not a sociologist, this is just basically a scale that ranks small chunks across the whole map of Scotland by how deprived they are. From the lowest score is the most deprived, and the top score is the least deprived. And what I've given you here is this is called a scatter plot. So you can kind of see visually how many groups are there and how they distribute. So we've got places of worship in Scotland, right? And then you compare that to eco-congregations in Scotland. So they're both kind of covering quite a lot of the range of deprivation. The next one over is transition towns. You can see there's a shift up. And then we've got the development trusts, and there's a shift down. And that's in part on purpose. Development trusts were conceived in part to reach some of the more rural areas of Scotland. You can see here with the bars, it's a little clearer how different groups map out. And what I've done here, the index of multiple deprivation, we've got one in England too. One of the problems with this is that it's a mashup of about 25 different social indices. And it can be a little bit misleading because one of those things actually relates to how remote you are. So if you have to drive a long time to get to a grocery store, you're considered deprived, which some of you may not consider deprivation. So what I've done is I've given you the income banding, the employment banding, and the employment skills and training banding. You can see they work out slightly differently.
What's the one on the far right?
The far right is it's education, skills, and training, which is a consolidation of five or six statistics relating to the number of people who have university degrees, representation of skilled trades, I think. I've got a PDF I could send if anyone wants to know more about IMD. So essentially, income, employment, and education are those three. And then the left is the aggregated scale. To give you a very brisk summary of what we've just been looking at, eco-congregations tend to span a wider range of deprivation than other types of groups, which tend to consolidate at the bottom or the top. And I think this is particularly the case when you look at education, which is interesting. So income is not quite as much of a dividing category as education seems to be. One of the other things that you may have assimilated but not noted from that map is that eco-congregations are quite numerous. In fact, it's the most numerous type of environmental group in Scotland. And this is the kind of thing that I mention when I mention this in meetings with people who are doing policy work in Scotland. They're always a bit astonished. So there are 407 eco-congregations in Scotland. There's about 2,000, roughly, I think, in England and Wales right now. If you compare that to Friends of the Earth, there's 11 local groups, you know, mostly in the major urban areas. You compare that to Transition, it's a little hard to define whether a group is active or not, so we're in the 80s, I think, right now with Transition. Even compared to Development Trusts, of which there are many, and they have a whole office with a full staff, and they're doing amazing work. But even then, there's not as many. There's 233, I think, at my last count. It might be up towards 250, but still, a lot of eco-congregations, which also makes them interesting as an object for study. The next question that I usually get when I'm talking about eco-congregations is, so how are they different? And I used to have quick answers to that question, and I've become a little bit cautious, and I'll give you a couple of reasons why. One of them is that I found, particularly in the interviews and some of the closer work that we did, that a lot of people have multiple identities or multiple participations, or both, depending on how you want to define those two terms. So I talked to someone who was in an eco-congregation group, and afterwards, she sort of pulled me off to the side and said, my husband and I are members of Greenpeace. And I mean, interesting that it was whispered, interesting that they have dual participations, and then what does that mean for a person to be involved in several different environmental groups, right? You put on your Greenpeace hat and you do one thing with that group, you take it off, you put on your eco-congregation hat, you do other things. So where is the action actually coming from there? And I'm not very eager to parse it out too discreetly. But I think we can sharpen the differences in certain instances. And one of the places where we can do this is when we talk about public policy, particularly energy policy. And so for the sake of this study, I took a look at the Climate Challenge Fund, which is the major Scottish policy instrument for climate change mitigation. It's been around since 2008. They've given out, I think, probably more like £70 million by now. They've got about 800-900 projects. I've got a data set you can get off of GitHub if you want to run the run the numbers yourself and do some analysis. A couple of features of it, though, is that it has to be focused on carbon metrics. So you have to find some way of accounting for the carbon reduction that your project achieves. You can only get 150,000 pounds, and they have a maximum horizon of 2 years for a project. And those are very important things to note. They have four criteria in terms of assessing applications, and it's the first two that I want to focus on in our discussion today. The first one is community, and the second one is carbon reduction. And what I want to argue is that these two exist in a very interesting dialectic, right? So here's a word cloud. I took all of the narratives from all 900 applications and generated a word cloud, and everyone was a little bit surprised that community was in the middle, actually. We were expecting carbon and energy to be, boom, right in the middle. But so what this tells me is that we've got two different priorities which are perhaps in competition in terms of the way that they parse out in actual projects. And I'll give you an example of how this works out. So eco-congregations have gotten about 4.5% of these projects, so about 3 million pounds and an average of 80,000 pounds per project. That's about 41 projects in total over the span of the whole program. I compared that to transition town groups, and this was all sort of manually sorted, so there is, I'm sure, some variance here. But what I found was that, assuming that I probably left out some transition groups, they've gotten 5.5%, so considerably more awards and considerably more money per award than eco-congregations. But what I found the most interesting is that if you actually look at the genre of what people are pitching for their projects, eco-congregations projects are almost always about infrastructure. 70% of the time, it's a boiler replacement or window glazing or something very mundane about their building. Now, we could extrapolate some conclusions about what eco-congregations do based on this, but what I'd like to argue is that they're responding to a policy instrument in a certain way, and that instead of assuming that eco-congregations just want to fix their building and care about their little patch, then actually the policy instrument is limiting what they can even attempt, and there's a mismatch here. So, and this comes out if you look at the application narratives, right? So here's transition projects. I did another smaller word map. So transition, but carbon. But you see there's food, local, recycling in there, people, skills. And then here's the eco-congregations. There's a few other religious groups I put in there just to keep things interesting. There's a Gurdwara and two mosques, I think. But generally, much more carbon metric focused, much more infrastructure focused in terms of the language that we're seeing there. Okay, so here's where I'm going to throw out some possible interpretations of what's going on here. And this is coming from the ethnographic work that I and team members have done. And I'll try to keep this quick so we can work this out in the questions, because I know I'm just about out of time. Here are some things that I think are at work in the dynamics of this interplay with the Climate Challenge Fund, right? One thing that we found when we talk to people in eco-congregations is what we're calling the modest witness. That is, people typically underreport their achievements. There was one really dramatic example of this where I was doing field work in a community that has an extremely robust community energy project, and there's this little Church of Scotland parish, and they've got a little windmill. Isn't that nice? The windmill's powering the parish. And you talk to them, that's all they talk about. But then I followed them around for a few days and discovered that every single member of the board for the community energy project, which generates, I think, 1.5 million pounds a year of income for the community and renders them net positive producer of energy, every member of the board comes from the church. And it turns out that it was they who actually founded the project. But when they're wearing their project hats, they're not wearing their eco-congregation hats. So they don't report on that activity when they're talking about what they do when they're in their eco-congregation, right? So there's a certain amount of modesty that's undermining what we can gather from them in these kinds of quick encounters, the quick research encounters. The other thing that's going on is that eco-congregations are very community-focused. And I'm not the first person to suggest this. There's another study by Smith and Pulver, and they foreground this as well in some of their interviews. And what they found is that, generally, the focus is not climate change mitigation. The focus is on helping our people to work more effectively together, to be a better community, and to do all those things in a way that mitigates climate change. And one consequence of that is that we're not going to mitigate climate change as our primary objective. That's going to be the end result of a kind of telos, to put it as a philosopher. So another thing that you find when you talk to people in these congregations, they'll very much talk the talk about carbon metrics. If you ask them, what are you doing here? You wouldn't even know it's a congregation. But then if you sit down and talk for a few more hours, and you really get down to the nitty-gritty, you'll find out that the primary motivations are more like social justice and intergenerational care. We've got an article coming out in a few months where we actually chart out some of the emphases there with people. Generally, I think, because of these emphases, because of the specific kinds of things that are happening in these congregations, I think one of the conclusions that I'd like to draw is that they need longer planning horizons. I think constraining a 2-year planning horizon is really a 1-year project in terms of practical application. And I think that's causing these groups to only do infrastructure work, because that's the only thing you can really accomplish in a year. If you want to talk about community investment and community mobilization, at least in the way that eco-congregations do it, we need to change the structure of the instrument. Okay, so a couple of unqualified recommendations, which I hope will generate some discussion. You can challenge me on whether you think these are robust or not. I'd like to suggest that when we're designing policy instruments like the Climate Challenge Fund, or whether we're assessing its robustness, that we start to think about local values and do user engagement in a way that's not just about messaging, but it's actually about tailoring policy instruments to the kinds of inflections that a local community of practice has that's kind of coming out of the way that they live together. I think we need to create funding schemes with a longer time frame, which is quite counterintuitive with something like climate change, which is all about apocalypse, and which is all about global emergencies. And there's a rhetoric and there's a global industry that's all about being in a constant state of emergency. So to come in and say, let's slow down, let's create policy instruments that take a long time, seems counterintuitive, it will probably be unpopular, but I think it's the right approach. And then finally, I think there is some room to support congregations in particular as community anchors. There's another whole area of research on community anchors and what they represent. But I think this is one area where we could particularly focus because they're embedded in the community in a unique way. More so than a lot of other types of environmental group, which tend to be composed of people from outside the community or from people who are intergenerational members of a community. I can talk more about that in the Q&A if you want to hear some more about that. But then I do tend to get this reaction from people when I make these proposals, say, well, that's all well and good with your ideals, but what about the real world? And so this got me to thinking, what do we do in the real world when we're talking about investment? And I'm hoping there's at least one or two economists here who can fill in the blanks here for me. But I'm pretty sure that when we talk about venture capital for small to medium-sized enterprises that are starting from nothing and that are trying to scale all the way up to a product that they deliver and then they get a return on that investment, I don't think 12 months is a reasonable expectation in any of those cases. I think 24 months is probably not reasonable either. You might have benchmarks or milestones, but really. So, I mean, what are we aligning to in terms of our expectations here? Is it the real world? Similarly, in terms of what we're expecting for failure, right? I think there's an expectation that anyone who receives public funding is a smashing success, okay? I've got lots of friends who have got venture startup funding because I grew up in Seattle and there's a lot of crazy things going on there. I can tell you from talking to them that there's about a 90% failure rate in that space. What would it look like if we tried to design a policy instrument for mitigating climate change that we understood would have a 90% failure rate? And I'm not so interested in what the public would think, because that would be difficult, but I'm interested in how the groups would respond. What if we said, take risks, try that thing that you've been imagining, but you knew that it probably wouldn't fly. Try that thing which is so explicitly religious that you knew it would take a long time to really express well and work out in your community, right? So this is my polemic. I think we have expectations in terms of public policy, but I'm not sure they're really aligned to the real world. And if we were to align them to the real world, I think there are some changes that we should make. I think we should slow down a bit. I think we should inflect more effectively, particularly with regards to religious groups. And I think that we should think about raising the ante and offering more than £150,000. What could they do? They could hire staff, develop infrastructure, or maybe we could just, you know, re-centralize all of our energy policy. But I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. So I'll leave it there. I'll be very curious to hear what Mike has to say in reaction to all of this, and I'll be curious to hear what questions you've got. And thanks very much for listening.
Thanks very much indeed, Jeremy. I'll hand over straight to Professor.
Okay, shall I stand up here? So thanks, Jeremy. It's interesting to hear about your view that large gatherings of geographers are strange. As a geographer, it always amazes me, actually, that people try to solve these sorts of questions without reference to the geographical skills and traditions that we have as people who are disciplined in our early formative years to think about the world in a much more holistic way than many other disciplines. So for me, actually, there's my own personal story here, which I won't bore you with, but how I started off in geography, left geography, and then I've come back to geography, all around this question of climate change. But actually, geography is a very good place to study. Okay, two or three thoughts. I was very interested in the way you framed this, this study, in the talk here, at least, drawing attention to the apparent frustrations of trying to secure successful change that minimizes risks of climate change, whether science-driven or international politics-driven, or even, as you suggested, by certain types of religious leadership or moral leadership that emanates from the center as opposed from the periphery. And then you counterpose that with what you're interested in is this focus on local community or place-based organizations. I'm sympathetic, of course, to that criticism of how climate change is framed, which is something that, you know, I've been writing about for a decade or so. And actually, where you end up here on this last slide actually simply reinforces, I think, one of the arguments that I'd make. Is that the way climate change has been structured as a phenomenon and as a problem or a challenge for humanity, it started at the center, it started with science, very clearly it started with science in the 60s and the 70s. It got appropriated by the international community in the late 80s, 1990s, including, actually, interestingly, international NGOs. And then we had this machinery of the UNCCC set up with the expectation that actually this was the nature of the problem, therefore this was the nature of the solution that's going to be needed. And so actually there's a structural problem at the very heart of what climate change is for most people. That still people hear this idea of climate change is about the globe, it's about coordinated or collective global action, it's about governments negotiating deals, it's about governments who've negotiated a deal sticking to a deal. So if Trump comes along and takes America out, well, the whole thing collapses. That's a very particular way of structuring the sort of phenomenon that climate change is. And I think here you're opening up and drawing attention to very different ways of understanding what people think in community. So I'm interested in all of that. I'm interested, of course, in the values-driven, values-centered approach here that you're emphasizing. After I wrote my book in 2009, it was the year after that, here in the UK, there was a report prepared by five NGOs, by a guy called Tom Crompton, called Common Cause, The Case for Working with Our Cultural Values. And it came across as though this was a sort of an enlightened moment for these NGOs, suddenly realized that human values actually matter. If you actually have a normative agenda or a normative goal. But what was interesting in that 120-page report that Tom Crompton led, there was no mention of religion. It talked about intrinsic and extrinsic values, it talked about value-driven behaviours, it talked about identities, but it completely was blind to the existence of religion. And I find that quite a significant blind spot. I think things have changed a little since then. So not only do values matter, but the ways in which humans gather together in community, and historically, and still today in the world, religion matters. Whether it's identity, sense of belonging, whether it's some sort of larger narrative of human purpose in the world that gives sort of orientation and steers, So I think it's really interesting to, in your study here, focusing on a particular set of religious communities and how they think about engaging with these sort of questions. The other interesting thing, I know it's not the focus of your research, but it's just worth pushing out here, because a lot of this is around community. There's a lot of interesting work done on sociological and geographical work done on what actually is meant by community. And of course, this is something that has been appropriated, again, in this architecture of climate change, but also very, very, very deliberately in the UK in recent years. I think you did briefly mention this in terms of the big society, and actually even these challenge funds, these climate challenge funds. For organisations to bid into these challenge funds, whether in Scotland or in England or Wales, you have to sell yourself as a community. You have to invent yourself. Exactly. Because if you don't, you're not going to get past the first filtering for these funds. So actually, it wasn't one of your word clouds. You sound as though you're quite surprised that community was at the centre of it rather than carbon reductions. But community was bound to be at the centre of these documents, because unless you sold yourself as a community, then you're not going to be eligible to get access for these funds. So I think, yes, we know at sort of a popular level, yeah, community is a warm, fuzzy, positive-sounding word. We all like to be in communities. But we also need to realise how particular institutions or political agendas can instrumentalise community, or at least can force people to think of community in ways that are not organic, and are not these sort of self-binding entities that are captured by some larger vision of purpose. And I think, you didn't quite answer the question, maybe you could say a little bit more. Are eco-congregations, I mean, you sort of hinted that they are a little different from the other recipients of some of these grants. But maybe you could say a little bit more about, in what sense do you think they are different? In the sense that you could argue that religious organizations do have a larger narrative, a larger sense of action in the world, whether you call it a moral purpose or whether you call it a sense of collective identity shared around a myth that is powerfully mobilizing. I think there might be something more to be said about that. And then the last thing I'll simply say is just coming back to this, which is this tension between carbon metrics and what you identify here is, I think this came out of the eco-congregation analysis, that actually what the eco-congregations were concerned with was not the metrics per se, but other activities that actually strengthened their sense of acting together. And this is again the tension right at the heart of how we see ourselves responding, what sort of problem we think climate change is, and how we see ourselves responding to the problem of climate change. Is it about the carbon metrics? Or actually, is what climate change does, it opens up deeper questions about who we are as humans, our duties, our responsibilities to the distant other, to the near other, to the far future, to the non-human, how these connect with our aspirations and hopes of good life and good living. And none of that can be captured in the fact that you've reduced your carbon emissions by 3.4% in the last year. And that just doesn't do it. And so to me, for me, climate change is this, it's an allegory, or it's a synecdoche. It's standing in for something else. And carbon metrics will never actually do that job effectively of touching and reaching these deeper questions that what drives us as human beings to live well in the world. And so it's not surprising to me, in a way, that one of your conclusions here is that to really mobilise and to engage, you've got to tap into these other things rather than the very instrumental reductionist, which a central government agenda like the Climate Change Challenge, or indeed like the Paris Agreement, which is, at all costs, we've got to keep it to 1.5 degrees. No, not at all costs. It actually matters how you get to 1.5 degrees or the 2 degrees.
Yes.
Yeah. So you've opened all that up, but also I've got one or two other questions I think here about the nature of community, and in particular the nature of religious communities and how different they really are from other community groups. But anyway, thank you.
Thank you.